Hello and welcome to this discussion with Dr. David Thunder. Dr. David Thunder is a political philosopher from the University of Pamplona in Spain, and he has authored a book called Citizenship and the Pursuit of the Worthy Life, published from Cambridge University Press, edited a collection of essays titled The Ethics of Citizenship in the 21st Century, published by Springer, and he's a very outspoken critic of various bad practices nowadays. Now, I must say, Dr. Thunder, I came across your work about a month ago when I was researching about the new anti-free speech bill that is being pushed forward in Ireland. And I must say that I got very much interested really in how someone who is simultaneously an academic and talks about issues, because this is not very, very frequent. Usually we are used to academics who are being a bit vocal later on in life, let's say, when they're just about to exit academia, or a really sea of silent people. So that got me interested, and especially I was really happy to see that you are talking about citizenship, and I'm frankly, I want to find more about your work.
Sure, yeah. It's great to be here, and I'm delighted to be on. It's a privilege. And I'll just begin by saying that the reason why I have been so outspoken about issues, a number of issues, including free speech and potential attacks, let's say, or threats to free speech, is that all of my academic work is driven by a passion for freedom and for civil freedom, for freedom in the political sphere, but also in the personal sphere, and even freedom, interior freedom within the soul. So every level of freedom fascinates me, and so for me it was a very natural thing for someone who studies freedom to then speak out when freedom comes under attack.
Yes, this is a really slippery term, the term freedom, and it seems to me that it has assumed a sort of symbol in most people's minds, especially after the after the Cold War, but it is very insufficiently understood. And it seems to me that especially when we have a notion like that, that has become a symbol, many people have really weird connections to it, and they frankly don't see many of the threats to it. Do you think that this is an accurate thing to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of freedom is similar to the idea of equality. It can mean different things to different people. It can be given very ideological interpretations that perhaps serve certain political interests. So, for example, some people interpret equality as meaning that we should all have the same income level. And I think that's a very problematic interpretation of equality, because it makes it pretty much requires a totalitarian type of state to enforce that kind of ideal. But regarding freedom, I think it's important to distinguish between license, liberty, and license to begin with. And John Locke, for example, one of the founders of modern liberalism, one of the founding fathers of liberalism, was very clear that ordered liberty, or what he called liberty, was quite different from what he called license, which is just doing whatever you want. Doing whatever you want without the constraint of law, without the constraint of rationality, is license. And license leads to anarchy, and license leads to destruction. So that's not what I certainly understand by freedom. I understand freedom to be ordered liberty. And that means freedom on the inside at the beginning, which means an order within the soul. Which means that rationality or reason has some kind of controlling function with respect to our passions. And then on the outside, I understand freedom to mean two things. One is the ability to construct your social world along with your peers, in cooperation with your peers, in a rational manner, in a way that is coherent and responds to worthwhile ends. And the other is the immunity from domination, the freedom from being dominated and or threatened by outside actors, whether it be the state or a private actor. So freedom is a complex concept, and it has negative dimensions, such as freedom from domination, but it also has positive dimensions, such as the ability to construct a social world that, you know, that is habitable, and that is, let's say, enriching for human beings.
Excellent. So the thing is, we have symposium number two, where Bo and I are talking about the various traditions of the notions of liberty. And we're talking about the positive, the negative, and the Republican tradition. By all means, if anyone is interested, check that out. Now, I want to ask you something about this. So I think that basically each tradition on its own is insufficient for maintaining a stable order. So, for instance, it seems to me that if we just focus on negative liberty, we are basically ending up with societies like the societies that we are living in today. We can flesh this point out in a bit. It seems to me that also the tradition of positive liberty, that understands liberty as something like rational self-mastery, can be distorted as well. And also the notion of liberty as non-domination in the Republican sense seems to me to be nice on paper, but I really don't know how and whether there is a coherent plan in creating a society where basically there is such a kind of freedom, or at least a very significant degree of it. Do you think that the Republican notion of freedom is a bit utopian, or do you think that to some extent it can work? I really hope it can work. Because I really like that tradition. But I would be really interested to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, there are two strands to the Republican tradition. One is what we might call the neo-Roman Republican tradition of, say, Skinner and Pettit, which focuses a lot on the idea of freedom as non-domination, or not being mastered by another, not being in a master-slave relationship. And that's one dimension which I find useful for thinking about certain aspects of freedom, particularly the vulnerability to predatory behavior by powerful actors. So it's important that those vulnerabilities be reduced by things like rule of law and by, you know, punishments, suitable punishments for you know, predators. But there's another Republican tradition, which is what you might call a more positive civic Republican, neo-Aristotelian Republican tradition. I suppose I would think of that tradition as emphasizing the value of freedom as self-mastery, as you said, rational self-mastery. And to be a good citizen and to have a functional civic life actually means to govern one's own life and the life of one's community in accordance with reason and or with rational criteria and and through rational deliberation. Right now, that value for the neo-Roman Republicans like Pettus, they instrumentalize that kind of positive freedom as self-mastery and self-government. And they say, well, we really just need self-governing communities in order to protect freedom as non-domination. And I don't buy this, because I think that positive freedom, the ability to shape our community life, and indeed to shape my own life, I think is a very precious type of freedom, and a freedom that we have good reason to value. And I certainly would not say that it's purely an instrumental value. I think it has intrinsic value. Okay. So these two strands of republicanism should actually be able to come together. And I believe the way Pettit frames freedom as non-domination, it doesn't really work, because for him, non-domination is sort of like the axiom, the rock bottom value of republicanism, like it's the central principle. But if we back away from that extreme position and just consider non-domination as one of the principles of republicanism or of a free society, then surely, in fact, I would say positive freedom is more fundamental than negative freedom. That would be my argument. It's more fundamental because ultimately, if I have negative freedom, if I'm not being dominated by others, but I'm not pursuing worthwhile ends or achieving something that is intrinsically valuable, then my life is a failure.
Two questions. Are you working on a theory where you are giving such an argument? Is there something like a new book that you are preparing or something?
Yes, exactly. So I am actually preparing a book in the final stages of preparation, which is called The Polycentric Republic, A Theory of Civil Order for a Free and Diverse Society. And this book on the Polycentric Republic actually does draw on elements of the Republican tradition, in particular, the idea of the importance of rational self-government and the importance that communities be able to govern their own lives. And not just the political community, but actually even non-political communities or civil society communities. So this book takes a much more positive approach to freedom than, say, the neo-Roman Pettit Skinner approach. Because the value that I consider to be the pillar of a free society is what I call the freedom to flourish.
Okay.
So the freedom to flourish basically is the ability to pursue human flourishing in a way that is responsive to my own rationally informed and uncoerced choices.
Okay.
Right. So basically the idea is that freedom separated from flourishing is pretty much worthless. If there's no flourishing, then freedom is sort of doesn't really enrich a human life.
Okay.
Right. So that's why I put flourishing at the center of my account. And then basically, just very quickly, basically the idea of this book is that we need to give a lot more leeway to local communities to structure their own life and govern their own lives. And that means that the normative order of the state has to be a lot more minimalist, a lot less interventionist than it actually is at the moment.
Okay. Now, the second question I was thinking about has to do with the distinction between liberty and libertinism. Because it seems to me that nowadays there is an argument that increasingly more paternalistic governments are making, that they are portraying liberty as sort of identical to libertinism. And it seems to me that there is such a thing, such a tendency in Western societies for governments to become a bit more paternalistic or maternalistic, however you want to call it. And there is this idea that government officials want to pose as knowing best than people, and they sort of fetishize emotions. They say that emotions are really pivotal for flourishing and that they need to respect people's emotions. And they are, it seems to me that they're pushing forward really aggressive legislation in the name of protecting people. And I would like us to move to the Irish Anti-Free Speech Bill, which I believe is called Criminal Justice Act 2023, but correct me if I'm wrong.
2022.
Oh, 2022. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that when I was reading bits from it, it seemed to me as if, you know, they're portraying Ireland as a sort of society filled with hate. And I don't understand. This seems to me to be way over the top. And just I'll read from the first page from this bill. It says, this bill is supposed to be an amendment to the law relating to the prohibition of incitement to violence or hatred against a person or a group of persons on account of certain characteristics, referred to as protected characteristics, of the person or the group of persons, and to provide for an offense of condoning, denying, or grossly trivializing genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and crimes against peace, and etc. So there are many problems with this bill. And it seems to me that it's very extreme even for a hate speech bill, because most hate speech bills are focusing on the distribution of hateful content, which in itself can be understood as a really weird notion. But here we're not just focusing on the distribution. We are told that even the possession of hateful content or the preparation of hateful content is something that should be prosecuted. You have spoken a lot about it. Do you want to give me just your view on how important and how dangerous this bill is?
Yes, I'd like to clarify that this bill is actually an update of existing legislation from 1989 called the Incitement to Hatred Act.
Yeah.
And that act actually contains many of the problematic features of this current bill. So just to clarify, one of the features it includes is that inciting hateful feelings towards certain groups with your speech, is considered to be a crime. So that in itself is rather problematic already, because the idea that I am criminally responsible for the feelings of my listeners, for what feelings might arise in their hearts as they listen to my speech, just is patently absurd. The idea that you could possibly criminalize speech because it incites feelings, negative feelings in other people. I don't know where to start even with that, but let's just say that a public sphere that is vibrant must involve controversy. Citizens will obviously disagree, and they'll disagree strongly on controversial issues. And they, passions will rise. People will become, nervous and het up about issues. That's what happens when you have an open public sphere and when you have actual argument.
Society, I may add.
Yes, in a free and dynamic society, people will express themselves openly. And when they do so, they will say things that upset other people because we don't agree on. There's a lot of stuff we don't agree on. So the idea that, someone might interpret something that I say, take it the wrong way or be upset by it, and thereby form a hateful feeling towards one of these 10 or 8 or 10 protected groups, and therefore I could go to jail.
Yeah.
That to me is something out of 1984. It's something that's absolutely not.
It's totalitarian, basically, because no one can have any control over that, because there are infinite interpretations of any claim. So if we are talking about the possibility of reading and interpreting something as being hateful content, as meriting not speaking, then no one would speak. And this is,
yes,
this may already be to concede too much, because this is an argument that we could be putting forward even if we assume that there can be such a thing as hateful content, which, okay, of course, I think that in some cases there can be hatred and there can be such a thing as incitement to violence. There are problems with, as you say, incitements to hatred, but it seems to me that it's problematic even if we grant this assumption for the sake of debating. Because anyone...
Yes, you mean the assumption that there is hateful speech out there.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's deceitful speech, there's annoying speech, there's anger-inciting speech, there's excited speech, there are all sorts of there's lots of speech out there that's bad, that we don't like, that is harmful for society. But we don't shut down speech because we think it could upset people, or it could be politically incorrect, or that it could potentially be hateful. The real issue here is that it's not with the moral ideal of hate, of non-hateful speech. I mean, I share this ideal, that we should not be, pigeonholing people, expressing, ignorant prejudices towards people, putting them in these boxes and, denigrating them because they belong to this race or this religion or whatever. That's all lamentable that happens. Well, lots of lamentable things happen in society, but we don't make everything that's bad illegal. Yeah. And there's a reason for that. And it's because there are certain kinds of offense that if you try to criminalize them, you will end up, making the law extremely ambiguous and very difficult to understand. Yeah. So the idea of a hateful speech, for example, there's a distinction in this law between incitement to hatred and reasonable contributions to public discourse.
Which is a very nebulous concept, because on its own, we could say, yeah, okay, there is such a thing as reasonableness, there is such a thing as contribution to public discourse. But the question is, who judges what constitutes a reasonable contribution to public discourse? And I may say that the more time goes by, the less optimistic I am that the bureaucrats entrusted with the power to make such judgments, that they can actually make them well. That may be a bit too pessimistic on my behalf, but what do you think about this?
Well, it goes back to something you said earlier, that hate speech laws are highly paternalistic.
Yeah.
Because what they do is they set up a kind of thought police, which would be the state or the representatives of the state or the agencies of the state, including police officers who have to make judgments about whether to arrest somebody, prosecutors who have to make the same, you know, the judgment about whether to prosecute. And really the issue here is that why would we assume that people, just because they're state officials, will have better judgments about what counts as hateful speech versus reasonable contributions to discourse? Basically, people who are public officials are just like you and me. They're actually often they're even worse than ordinary citizens. So, in terms of their motivations, they have a lot of access to power very often. And power, as the old adage goes, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. To have that power at your disposal, it starts to go to your head, and you can very easily start to kind of set yourself up as a kind of an expert, as a superman, as someone who can stand above the masses and look down on them and tell them how they should live their lives and instruct them on what kinds of discourse are acceptable and unacceptable. And I think people who approve hate speech laws and disinformation laws, I think that they are extremely, either they are politically calculating that the people who enforce those are on their side, so they'll help them out, which could be one possibility, right? The cynical interpretation. Or they're just hopelessly naive and they think that people in power are philosopher kings who have this superior God's eye perspective on reality and who can make much better decisions than ordinary people, and can sit up on moralistic high thrones and look down on the people and point out who has deviated from their social norms, which now, by the way, are no longer social norms, but legal norms.
Yeah.
Because really it's a codification of ideology, of a kind of moral ideology, about, you know, appropriate and inappropriate types of speech and attitude. And it really intrudes into the internal sphere of thought and the private sphere of the home, because this particular bill, in fact, goes even further than other hate speech laws, because what it does is it criminalizes the mere possession of content that would be deemed likely to incite hatred in society. The mere possession. So police could get a warrant to come into your home, search your home, force you to give your password to open up all your electronic devices, seize your devices, and arrest you because you had a text sitting on your computer that they thought could incite, no, technically it's would likely incite hatred. Yeah.
Which it doesn't even have to be actual. It doesn't have to have incited violence. They say that it is likely to incite. And they don't even run the test.
No need to run the test. And they preemptively shut it down.
And one question here, because this seems to me to be a very totalitarian aspect of this bill, because, of course, every time we talk about legislation is you know one thing. There is also the question of law enforcement. That is another thing. So the question is, if, let's say, you know, people legislate something like that, how can they enforce such a law without actually getting the warrants that you just mentioned? So it seems to me to be a malicious way into pacifying the population into accepting such a thing, into accepting that it is something that, of course, the means for which practices like that are being enacted are the good mean, are good. The ends for, and this seems to me to be, what is the end? The end is protecting the subjective feelings of not everyone from the population, but from some protected groups. So for me, that would be wrong in both sides. I would not like a government to say that I want to respect the feelings of people, and they give they put forward an interpretation of what constitutes respect for the feeling of people. I would think that's a recipe for disaster. But here there's an extra step, because it's not, I think it's not just the people in general. It's some protected groups who possess protected characteristics. And I was reading it, for instance, it says here, some protected characteristics are race, color, nationality, religion, national or ethnic origin, descent, gender, sex characteristics, sexual orientation or disability. And in gender, it says, gender means the gender of a person or the gender which a person expresses as the person's preferred gender or with which the person identifies and includes transgender and a gender other than those of male and female, etc. So it seems to me that this bill is just created to stop debating and stop brainstorming in civil society.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think you can imagine a number of scenarios in which somebody could be prosecuted. It's impossible to say in advance who will be prosecuted, because the categories are so nebulous, the category of hate speech, that it will depend on what the judge decides, right? And given whatever judge you get on, it's Monday, it'll be Judge Samuel, and if it's Tuesday, it'll be Judge Freeman or whatever. And you'll have no idea what they're actually going to decide really in advance, because it'll depend on these very arbitrary subjective judgment calls. But one could easily imagine a scenario in which, for example, supposing someone is writing an article that is very critical of transgender operations for children, right? Yeah. And they make references to the trans movement as being irresponsible, for advocating those kinds of operations, or at least the parts of the trans movement that advocate that. And then, you know, some people from the trans movement make a complaint to the public prosecutor, and they say that that somebody I shared my article with before publishing it, say I shared it with a colleague, and that colleague then brought it to the attention of the public prosecutor and said, I think he might publish this. In fact, it looks like he intends to publish this. I've read it. It looks very incendiary, because it basically is very critical of the practice of transgender operations or, you know, trans hormone therapy for children. And he suggests that trans people, or at least that some parts of the trans movement, are child abusers. Yeah. And he could say, you know, this is going to attract hatred towards our community. Because if the community thinks that some of us are abusing children, then it would be natural for them to feel hateful towards us, and they might generalize towards the whole community.
Yeah.
And he could make that kind of argument. Now, would a judge accept that argument and issue a warrant to search my get access to my property and my computer? It's your guess is as good as mine. Honestly, we don't know. I give the example also of myself. I'm Catholic. You know, I should be one of the protected categories because religion is a protected category. So if somebody decided to go after Catholics and say that we're backward and we don't really deserve to be, you know, in the public sphere, we should just go back to our rosaries or something.
Yeah.
I don't like that kind of speech, and I disagree profoundly with it, but I would not be comfortable with a society in which the state could prosecute that person and jail them because they criticize my way of life. If they could come after them, they can come after other people in society, and they could shut down speech, and it will become politicized eventually because it's so arbitrary and it's so subjective that it just invites ideological and political manipulation.
Yeah. So one last question about the bill. It seems to me that it's completely unpopular. How is it that we have come to this? I've heard something like 80 or 90% of the people are against it. Are these numbers accurate?
I'm not familiar with an opinion poll, an official opinion poll or recent poll that shows 80 or 90% against it. But I know that the submissions, I know there have been polls done in which there was quite a while ago, in which there was a majority against this legislation.
Yeah.
And I also know that the submissions from the public consultation, over 70% of the submissions were critical of the bill, were against the bill.
Okay.
So there is no public demand for this bill in terms of, say, a surge of popular demand for the bill. It's clearly coming out of the political establishment. It's coming out of the elite political circles. And, you know, I think a lot of people speculate that probably this bill is driven by NGO activity and lobbying. That's the most likely explanation because it just seems to come a little bit out of the blue, without really any public demand for it, and against popular opinion. So this means that, as I said, there's probably people pulling levers behind closed doors, probably a lot of lobby activity going on.
Okay. So there's a question here because I want to link this to the question of citizenship. Because for me, there is a very worrying tendency that has been playing on for years. I want to share with you a small conjecture I have about it, and I really want to hear what you think about it. So for me, the thing is that the Western world has generated a kind of abundant material abundance, and this frequently, especially after the early 90s, this breeds a kind of mentality that of conceit, that there are basically no problems that Western societies can have. The Western societies are so high and mighty that they basically have solved all the problems. As I think Francis Fukuyama was saying in a sometimes misunderstood claim that, you know, the liberal constitutional democracy has been the end of history and that there will be no other system after that. So for me, it seems to me that after the early 90s, there has been a sort of underestimation of problems such as multiculturalism and things like mass immigration. And there is also an issue with cosmopolitanism, I would say, but that's a third, that's eventually down the line. But for me, the thing is that this wealth in this social context created a really large class of people, I would say it's the overwhelming majority of people, who stopped being concerned citizens and they minded their own business. So this lack of engagement, this lack of political culture, let's say, created an imbalance of power where it was very easy for people, the NGOs maybe you mentioned, governmental officials, to basically take advantage of people not paying attention. And basically that's how we woke up right now in a world that has nothing to do with the world that we used to live in 5 or 10 years ago. And it seems to me that the key word here is habit. Many people are habituated into thinking that there is nothing wrong. They're habituated into not wanting to think that there are significant problems, which is why, for instance, very frequently I'm trying to tell people that, you know, there are some issues in society and they don't want to listen. Now, do you think that this has to do with a lack of active citizenship, or do you think that this theory is completely wrong?
Well, like a lot of theories, it's unlikely to be completely wrong. Usually theories have something interesting to contribute. So I would say that I find it interesting, this idea that wealth and affluence could induce complacency and perhaps a certain kind of disengagement from the public sphere. But frankly, I think that particular tendency, as they say, that horse left the stables a long time ago. Yeah. I mean, I think Tocqueville was already worried and he already saw Alexis de Tocqueville in the 19th century, the French philosopher. I'm sure everyone is familiar with him, but he was very worried that acquisitiveness and the race to acquire property and to basically, be more comfortable, that this could drive citizens further into the private sphere and kind of make them less, take their focus off public affairs and put their focus more on the ego, family, and on their own material well-being. And he already saw this in action in America in the 1850s, 40s, 50s. The 1830s and 40s. So he was already quite very conscious of the problem in the 19th century. Now, so in that sense, I don't think it's a completely new problem. And I do think that there's a structural tendency built into the modern post-industrialized state, which has become a kind of welfare state. There's a tendency built into it towards the centralization of power and authority. So the concentration of power in the federal government of the United States or in the national government of Europe, or in the European Commission, these tendencies of kind of power to move upwards mean that citizens are progressively more disempowered. That actually creates a cycle of disillusionment with politics and disengagement. Yes. Because when citizens feel disempowered, they feel that their participation will be useless, will not really make much difference. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because obviously if you think you won't make a difference, then you'll stop voting or you'll remove yourself from politics and you'll just devote yourself to things that you think you can make a difference in, such as making money and enjoying your family life and leisure activities. So it's very difficult to diagnose exactly what's happened. But if I had to point to a couple of things that have contributed to this disengagement from politics by ordinary citizens, I would say one is the concentration and centralization of power, right? Which literally disempowers communities and citizens and the people. That is one issue. And the other is individualization or the erosion of community, the fabric of community life, where communities become kind of dislodged from their moorings and from their roots. And you get this kind of post-traditional society in which people are relatively more mobile and also conceive their life in a more kind of individualistic way. You know, I'll forge my own life and my own path forward. And I don't need any church or any moral authority to tell me how to live. And I think this leads to communities breaking down over time and over generations. And when communities break down, they have a lot less resources to resist bureaucratic state, yeah, and the administrative state. So, you know, we just recently lived through a pandemic. We lived through very drastic types of social interventions. And I believe that those interventions would have been less accepted if communities had been more vibrant and robust, okay, and more well organized.
So do you think that, yeah, we were, mm-hmm, met with a divided public, and that the public would be less divided if it was structured in a more community-centered way?
Yes, I mean, you could think of it this way. You could think of it as the Leviathan state, to use that Hobbesian term, the Leviathan state, this sort of extremely powerful state. What can a single citizen do in the face of a Leviathan state? The single citizen is powerless before a Leviathan state. But when the single citizen unites with other citizens and creates a community or a movement, then they become visible,
yeah,
in society, and they have to be taken more seriously, and there's a force to be contended with. And so actually a lot of the aspects of the pandemic, really what they did was they seemed almost designed to further fragment communities, because social distancing literally was separating people into individual households. Yes. So there was really no way for them to, it was very difficult for them to coordinate or to form any kind of united front against the state.
This is a form of divide and conquer in the social sphere, that in order for the people in general to be controlled, they can be controlled more if they can be divided. And would you say that the effort to distort information and to distort debate has something to do with controlling population? So for instance, the bill we just discussed, it is a form of restricting public discussion. And public discussion is a way in which people, they can form a collective subject in ways with particular demands. So it seems to me that something like the bill we just discussed is a way of saying that, no, you're not allowed to discuss some topics. You're not allowed to make, yeah, demands that have, yeah, to, are, you could say, community-centered.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Aristotle says that we are unique among all kind of creatures, in that human beings have the capacity for language.
And to it's understand language, good and evil. Yeah.
To understand good and evil, and just and unjust.
Yeah.
And it's language that actually prepares us for, that equips us for political life. It's what equips us to engage with other citizens and to form a shared horizon of meaning. That's not Aristotle's, that's a modernized,
yeah,
of Aristotle. Okay. A shared horizon of meaning and to be able to communicate with each other and form a bond with others.
Yeah.
And so as you say, if you shut down the ability to communicate, then you are literally shutting down politics itself.
Yes.
And you are actually deactivating our political natures in some ways, or at least that you're suppressing our political nature, and you're converting us into something like passive individuals who would be
recipients of welfare.
Yeah. Recipients of welfare, yeah, subjects, slaves maybe, but if you don't want to go as far as slaves, let's say subjects of the state. Yes. Who do not have agency to decide for themselves how to live. They're instructed by the state how to live. Because if you can't debate, if you can't contend, if you can't, you know, push back verbally in the public sphere, then you can't mobilize, really, obviously, right? This is, yes, all totalitarian regimes know this.
Yeah.
And so every totalitarian regime, one of the first things they do is they try to control speech.
Exactly. and the media and the dissemination of information. Okay, so I want to ask you something a bit that is a bit more philosophical about citizenship, because I want to ask you, what do you think is the importance of citizenship for what we call the good life? Do you think that, for instance, it's an integral part? What is it about citizenship that makes it so important for our lives?
Yes. Well, I think that there are two aspects to this question. One is that citizenship could have an instrumental value, right? So that's actually more of the kind of neo-Roman kind of Philip Pettit approach. And there, and actually, I think there's a lot of truth to that, that engaging as a citizen is a way of, it's a defensive maneuver that can limit the damages that the state can do to my community.
Yes.
And at McIntyre, I would say roughly takes that kind of line. So, you know, I can't afford to ignore such a powerful actor as the state, or even my local municipal government. I can't afford to ignore them because they could do quite a lot of harm, you know, if they're not checked.
Yes.
And so maybe they're not, you know, angels, maybe they're not, well, obviously not angels or saints. And they're certainly, they may not even be competent, very competent, but at least I can maybe limit some of their damages they do to the community life. So that's one, that's the instrumental approach, because, you know, after all, living a good life surely is taking responsibility for warding off threats to the quality of my life and the life of my community, and our ability to actually live up to an ideal that's coherent, to educate our children, and, you know, in an ideal that we believe in and that we and that can help them grow as human persons. So that would be one aspect. The other aspect is the question of whether citizenship actually involves directly, let's just say, intrinsically valuable virtues.
Okay.
And intrinsically valuable character traits, let's say, or virtues. And whether or not it directly enriches a human life or makes our life fuller, more complete, participating in political life. And on that question, I'm a bit ambivalent, because I think that politics at the level of the state, the modern state, the value of engaging in that kind of politics is more of an instrumental value.
Okay.
I think. But I think in order to acquire those, like, let's say, the benefits of that engagement, I do have to develop human virtues.
Yeah.
Such as, you know, resilience or fortitude, you know, prudence in my interventions in the public sphere, courage in the face of adversity. There are a lot of magnanimity in the sense of trying to achieve worthwhile projects and sacrifice for those projects. You know, I think there can be really valuable character traits developed through our political engagement.
Okay.
But the form of political life that is most enriching, and that I would say is, can really complete a human life and not feel as alienating as engaging with the state politics, is probably something like being a citizen in a local community in which I'm able to help make decisions within that community.
Yes.
You know, that to me is a more richer and more coherent form of citizenship. And in my ideal, the ideal I put forward in the book that I'm working on now, is essentially that the majority of civic life occurs at the local level.
Okay. So would you say that if we buy into the idea that the majority of civic life occurs on the local level, we are moving back to a more bottom-up conception of society instead of a top-down conception of society where everything is basically going to be planned by the bureaucrats? in the latter case. I'm saying, are we moving away from that? If we see that society is mostly a spontaneous order, and we are using the state in order to mitigate some of the conflicts that arise in such a concept, as opposed to viewing the state as basically something that is going to create a plan for and to impose on the whole of society. Do you think that it moves towards the former?
Yes, I think bottom up is a way of describing this.
Yeah.
And I think that on my, these local communities, what they do is they're not completely self-sufficient. So they're not like the Aristotelian polis, because they're not completely self-sufficient. They're actually interdependent, and they're also dependent on a market, a market economy that actually transcends the limits, the boundaries of those small communities.
Yes.
So this means that they have no choice if they want to achieve their own flourishing. They have no choice but to cooperate with other communities and also to engage with or use coordinating mechanisms that will help them to achieve their goods and services. And so, or even to defend, even in terms of policing or military defense, all of this can happen by delegating authority to representatives who can represent their interests in assemblies or in councils that in a way coordinate the life of a larger society. But of course, this process of control and delegation, as I conceive it, at least, is a bottom-up process.
Yes.
So it's very different to the modern state in most cases, in which there's a national plebiscite, in which a majority of the national plebiscite, will determine who governs. I'm firmly believe in the idea that, like the Swiss cantons, Swiss Confederation. I think basically the idea that they have one of their houses or one of their chambers of the parliament is basically a kind of has like representatives from all of the cantons, and they have as far as I know they have, I don't know if they have exactly equal representation, but they have roughly equal representation.
Okay.
The cantons, right? So this is, or even the United States, the Senate gives equal representation to the different states, right? These are ways to recognize the equal standing of communities in the whole scheme. And they're a way to sort of push back against the majoritarian tendencies of modern democracy.
Okay.
And so I would be in favor of giving those senatorial chambers a much more dominant role in politics, giving them more power so that local communities have more of a check on central power.
Excellent. So you think that in a way we should move towards decentralization in order to offset the centralizing tendencies that we are encountering nowadays. So is that accurate? Yeah.
Yes, that's accurate.
Okay. Now, I want us to move a bit to another discussion that has to do with the Rawlsian idea of a public reason. And the reason I'm asking is because it seems to me that the kind of paradigm that we're living in is, to a large extent, influenced by the thought of John Rawls. And many people, especially in academia, who are let's say disciples or followers of Rawls, or people who draw inspiration from him without necessarily accepting everything he said, they do give some sort of arguments about the society we live in that frequently appeal to notions that Rawls makes. So the question is, there are many questions, by the way, but I want to ask you what you think about the following. It seems to me that both in A Theory of Justice and in Political Liberalism, Rawls talks a lot about autonomy, and he talks about autonomy in the context of the following of self-respect. And it seems to me that after Rawls, there has been a very major tendency, or we could say that the tendency was already present, but it was rephrased in Rawlsian terms afterwards, of treating self-respect, which is to some extent a subjective notion, as being the basis of what states should grant people. So would you say that we are sort of encountering an attempt to conceptually engineer the conditions that are associated with self-respect? And many people who are in favor of centralization and more centralizing governments, they are appealing to the notion of autonomy conceived of as such in order to push forward the centralization agenda that they have. Because frequently they do appeal to an idea of self-respect, and they do say that we want to restrict speech because hateful speech is harming people, and harming people requires harming their self-respect. And it means that we are not granting autonomy, which is what the liberal state should do. Do you think that there is, that this is sort of accurate, that Rawls has given a new phrasing to this to this centralizing tendency?
Well, there are a number of issues that you've raised there, so I'm going to try to take selectively.
So, sorry if I was a bit bombastic. But
No, it's fine. I'll try to just take a few a few of the issues that you mentioned. Centralization. Rawls, I'll start with the last issue of centralization. I think I would say that because Rawls, the way he idealizes justice and the way he idealizes political order, the way he theorizes political order, it's from the perspective of a unitary state. And the units are basically the individuals and the state. And he does recognize the individuals have a background culture, but the people who have standing to, let's say, negotiate the terms of cooperation are fundamentally individuals.
Yeah.
For Rawls. Okay. And so I think that what I would call the jungle of social life, the jungle of associational life that makes up, society, just sort of falls out of the picture for Rawls. It's really bizarre. It's like he just said it's the background culture. But then when it comes to designing principles of justice, it's a kind of social contract between individuals who constitute a single state. I mean, when you think about the implications of that, it basically means that local communities and sub-state associations have no independent standing in forming the social contract.
Yeah.
And it naturally limits our imagination and pushes us to think of political order in terms of an order that's conferred by a unitary state. There's no discussion of federalism. There's no discussion of municipalism. There's really, it's just the state, right, that occurs. And I'm sure Rawls, if he was alive, you know, God rest his soul, if he was alive, he would probably say, no, but I wasn't interested in the internal configuration of polities. I was just interested in idealizing, you know, developing a theory of justice. But I would say, actually, it is relevant because if your theory of justice is built for individuals as constituents of a unitary state, then you have fundamentally change the terms of the negotiation, because the negotiation should actually be between communities with different conceptions of justice.
Yes.
Where they have to negotiate with each other. So it's an indirect way in which Rawls pushes us towards the centralized state, mainly by the way he sets up the social contract, which, by the way, is, in my view, is the way that other contractarians have set it up as well. I don't think it's just Rawls. I think this goes back to Hobbes and Locke. and Rousseau even, I think they do conceive the social contract as a contract among individuals, fundamentally. And then as far as public reason and whether that is influencing our current culture, our civic culture, I mean, Rawlsian public reason specifically, I think we could say that there are important elements of Rawlsian public reason. It certainly seems to be mirrored in certain ideas that are current in our political culture. In particular, the idea that there's this shared set of principles that we can draw on. Rawls calls this the political culture. And he thinks there's a family of liberal conceptions of justice that we can just sort of be nourished by when we argue. And I mean, many people have criticized Rawls for this move. And I think this move will become more and more untenable. I think for a lot of people, it's a passé move that really, it's not even something that is almost worthy of serious debate.
Okay.
Because basically, but there are people who still buy this Rawlsian idea. But if you look at how society is actually the makeup of society, it's patently ridiculous to say that there's already a pre-existing set of conceptions of justice, liberal conceptions of justice, that can provide an overlapping consensus for everybody to agree on. No, I don't think that exists. I think that there, a more realistic approach is to say that there are probably certain procedural principles, like constitutional principles, that have broad consensus in society to do with how we make decisions and whether elections are valid. That might actually count as a kind of an overlapping consensus, because if that goes away, then we're in big trouble, because we need that. And so I think Rawls is way too ambitious in the amount of consensus he assumes in society. And so the reality is that insofar as there is consensus, it's constructed through discourse and it's built up through discourse between people who disagree. And so there's this weird static idea of public reason in Rawls where you have these pre-existing principles and then discourse departs from these pre-existing principles. Whereas for me, discourse is this messy thing where, you know, we agree on some things, maybe particularly the idea that, for example, I don't kill the people that I'm arguing with, or I don't use violence to impose my opinion in general. And that might be enough to get a conversation off the ground. But that's certainly not having a shared conception of justice.
Okay. So one thing to also to say for our audience, so Rawls seems to me, especially in political liberalism, and published in 1993, he seems to me to be accepting a kind of what he calls a kind of reasonable pluralism, which seems to be the idea that he accepts that he is in a society, or he is talking about a society where people are going to have different views of the good life, which he counts as reasonable. And his idea of the overlapping consensus seems to be a sort of idea where he says that, well, the only way to achieve a kind of coexistence is if every person, despite the fact that they have a comprehensive view of the good life, thinks in terms of public reason. And public reason is that, let's say, pool of reasons that are common to all these views of the good life. To people who embrace different views of the good life. But they accept that they cannot push forward the entirety of their view of the good life. Would you say that this is a way of thinking about it?
Well, that's Rawls's position, yes.
Okay.
I mean, that basically, that's his position, that it's about letting in the reasonable people.
Mm-hmm. Question here, which is also building on something you said before about communities. It seems to me that in the Rawlsian idea of public reason, concern about community seems to be a, I don't understand if it is within public reason in Rawls. So if Rawls thinks of society just as an aggregate of individuals who in behind the veil of ignorance try to legislate the, let's say, laws of the basic structure of society, there seems to me to be an insufficient appreciation of community. And the question comes here, what if people in a modern Western society start thinking that community is a value, and community is not just being with some people together in a geographical region? To be a member of a community is to have a sort of a common way of life that sometimes has much more in common than people in, let's say, multicultural societies have. And it seems to me that from a Rawlsian perspective, that would be sort of outside public reason, that we would not be allowed to think of it as being a value, because it would be unreasonable. It would be seen as sort of inciting hatred against other communities. Do you think I'm putting forward a completely far-fetched view here, or do you think that there's something there?
Well, I think that Rawls, as I suggested earlier, in the way he sets up the social contract, he doesn't give any clear standing to associations, groups, or communities within the state, under the jurisdiction of the state, to actually have standing to negotiate the terms of the social contract, the terms of cooperation. So I think in that way, his thinking about justice and his thinking about the constitution of the state is fundamentally individualistic. And therefore, it makes sense that he would neglect the role of communities in the constitution of the state. And I think that's definitely true. Now, regarding public reason, whether or not communities are relevant to public reason, what relevance they have, I think Rawls would say that, first of all, he'd say that the restrictions of public reason apply specifically to what he calls constitutional essentials, the debate of the basic structure of society, right, which is given by the state. And again, we have the statism here in the background. The basic structure of society is given by the state. And if we're debating that, then the rules of public reason apply, because that structure is coercive, because it restricts people's plans of life plans, and so on. So public reason basically is to apply to the basic structure of society, and therefore, and it's true that comprehensive doctrines, they can have a presence in public reason, but for Rawls, they have to endorse some form of overlapping consensus or some form of shared principles.
Okay.
And I mean, one could argue something like this. One could argue that, okay, you don't have to be a Mormon to understand the value of being in a Mormon community, you know, because it's actually the value of community life is a universal value. And therefore, you know, you can sympathize with a Mormon because you just understand that being in a community, I just picked that example at random of nothing against more. I have good Mormon friends, that, you know, you can actually sympathize with a Mormon because you understand the value of that good being in a community. And so public reason you could bring to public reason, you could say, okay, look, we need to protect communities. We need to allow them to have a certain amount of autonomy, to be able to direct their affairs. This is an important part of a flourishing life. You could make that argument within the bounds of public reason, right? You could still make that argument. The problem is that these diverse communities actually disagree on fundamentals about how to constitute the public sphere, what counts as a crime, what counts as human life, what counts as marriage, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no way to debate those issues from within public reason. I mean, because there isn't an overlapping consensus on those issues. So it's a failed project in that regard.
Okay, so I think we should focus on the last bit of our discussion and move back a bit to citizenship. And I want to say the following. It seems to me that many people are progressively losing faith to the idea of citizenship. And they constantly, everyone individually wants to have a voice, but they become a bit more pessimistic with the voice of other people. So, okay, you could say that there is a kind of problematic tendency there, but I would like to ask you if you want to say something to people who would think this way and say if you think that citizenship is something that is doomed to become less and less and less active, or whether there is any reason for being optimistic that people can be a bit more optimistic, or more concerned, more of concerned citizens and more active citizens.
Yeah. There are two aspects to this problem. One aspect is a cultural aspect, which I think you touched on earlier, which has to do with character. Yeah. And the development of character and social conventions and self-understanding and how we situate ourselves in the world, how we think of our life and our relationships. And you could say that an individualist mentality where I'm my own captain of my own ship, so to speak, and I'm going to, you know, forge my own path and my own career, my own professional life, my own family life. And I don't need to worry about other people. And I could just leave everything over to professional politicians. So that's a kind of an ethical attitude, I would say. It's an attitude of character. And it's a type of, let's say, indifference to the public sphere and to politics. And that is a cultural problem. So I think that has to be worked through education, through kind of helping people understand that your engagement in the political sphere matters. It matters for the future of your community, right? Yeah. People need to understand that. And that might take a crisis sometimes for people to understand that. But anyway, so that's one aspect. The other aspect is the institutional aspect. And that is that until there is more devolved power, until power is more devolved to communities, I believe that there are just hard limits to how much you can have an engaged citizenship or citizenry. People have busy lives. They have family, they have work, they have, you know, social life. They have a lot of things going on. And if they don't see the value added of their contribution, if they don't see that it's going to have an impact on their quality of life and the life of their neighborhoods and communities, then of course they won't be motivated to participate. And also they're, you know, the fact is that the institutions as they stand make the citizens' participation very much an uphill battle. If taxes are decided at the national level, I mean, if the vast majority of my taxes go to the national government, then I have almost no say over tax policy. There's no way for me to change. It's very difficult unless I'm a journalist, or unless I am a leader of a political party, or maybe I stand in parliament. I have negligible influence over the tax regime of my country. Yeah. So those issues, and that's just one example, but also the regulation of industry, the regulation of speech, insofar as there is regulated, or of media, all of these things are highly centralized in many, many countries. And this basically is saying to ordinary citizens, your voice doesn't matter. Because we're not interested in what you really have to say. It's better, in fact, that you have no influence, because that way the national political elites get to call the shots. Okay, and whether or not they think that or they say it, it doesn't matter. That the net effect of the institutional centralization that we have is that citizens at the local level, citizens living their ordinary lives, have unfortunately very little influence over national policy.
Yeah.
And that means over the policies that are applied to their lives. And you know, in Spain, for example, the socialist government recently, what they did was they passed a new education reform law that removed the ability of private schools that have any kind of public funding to decide whether to have girls and boys or just girls in the school. And it also removed the ability of those schools to compete for students in order to expand based on social demand, which was the previous model, that the schools, private schools, could expand with the help of public support if there was public demand, you know, if people wanted to send their kids to those schools. That's a progressive model in a good sense, because it allows, you know, supply and demand of the market to work. Yeah. Whereas they wanted to shut down the educational market by saying, you cannot expand, your enrollment will not reflect social demand, and we'll make it difficult for students to access you unless they live in the local area. Okay. So a whole lot of things that they did that basically were decided by the national parliament for the whole country. And that's completely disempowering.
Final question. Do you think there is any reason for optimism that people will be a bit more represented in the kinds of societies that we live in? That their voice will matter a bit more? And if not, how could that change? If you want to end with that note.
Yes, sure. It's a tough question. I think there are some signs. There are some indications that if people are pushed hard enough by their governments, that they will wake up to what's going on and that they will be mobilized. They will actually be motivated to push back and to mobilize. And so even if the institutions themselves are inherently limited, the political institutions, I would say that the regional elections in the Netherlands are proof that non-establishment parties that really come out of nowhere and that have almost no history. I mean the farmer citizen movement didn't even exist before 2019, and it now has, it's the largest party in the Dutch Senate, along with I think liberals and socialists. Like, there's a kind of a bloc that also has 15, I think it's 15 seats each. The point is that these people came out of nowhere, and the Dutch government put in place plans to expropriate Dutch farmers in the name of environmentalism against their will, coercively expropriate them, basically. And obviously with compensation, but that's not the point, that they were taking away their property in the name of promoting some environmental goal to do with reducing pollution or something. Now, this, I think, really galvanized the citizen farmer movement, and also it broadened its base of support, because it swept, it basically won the elections across almost all the regions. I mean, that's still at the Senate level, but the leader of the party herself was just flabbergasted. She couldn't believe their success. So what can we learn from that? We can learn that if there is a serious crisis, or if the government overplays its hand and becomes too tyrannical or too oppressive, then you can wake up the sleeping giant, and people can, in fact, form, they can mobilize successfully. And so I want to say that that would be a very positive note and realistic note to end on.
Excellent. And thank you very much for it. And it was a really nice comment to end with. And I hope you enjoyed our discussion a lot. And see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.